welcome back to another episode of Upzoned, where every week we take just one big story from the news and we upzone it. I'm Kia, and I am here with my colleague Daniel Harrigus today. How are you doing today, Daniel? Thanks for filling in for Chuck while he's out being presidential.
Being presidential, whatever that means. No, my pleasure.
Sure. Chuck is out doing an event for us out in Washington. It's sort of the kickoff of his spring event season. So I was really excited to have the opportunity to talk to Daniel, who had brought an article to my attention. And I happened to stumble on another article on the same topic about the INRIX Global Traffic Scorecard. Don't get too excited if you have no idea what that means. The INRIX Global Traffic Scorecard basically talks about how much money Americans lose, quote unquote, sitting in traffic each year. It makes recommendations to the transportation industry about new roads to build, et cetera. And it has some conclusions that this article from Planetizen that we're going to be talking about today, which you can read in the liner notes for this particular episode, finds a little bit problematic. So let's kick it off by kicking it to my very smart planner friend, Daniel. What is INRIX? What is this Global Traffic Scorecard? And what do you think of this year's edition?
So INRIX is a traffic analytics firm. They do various kinds of traffic studies. They consult with local governments and other entities, and they publish this global traffic scorecard in part as a way of drawing attention to themselves and drumming up business. But it gets a lot of media attention every year when it comes out because they publish a ranking of the most congested cities in the US as well as worldwide in some other areas. And they attempt to quantify the cost of highway congestion in these different cities. And they do it in a way that comes in every year for a lot of criticism within the planning profession, particularly within urbanist circles, because it's really fundamentally misleading.
Yeah. So what's so misleading about it? I was really interested in the Planetizen analysis of this that talks about basically this scorecard makes the suggestion that every American annually loses $1,348 by sitting in traffic. How do they get to that number? And where do you think they went wrong? I'm curious.
So there are a few places that I would say they go wrong in arriving at that number. One is that the assumed cost of congestion is based on a comparison to free flow conditions. So they look at what speed traffic is flowing at on a given highway when there's no congestion, no sort of delay whatsoever, even if that speed is actually above the legal speed limit. And then for any speed lower than that free flow speed, they deem that to be time lost to congestion, which doesn't really reflect. I mean, first of all, it doesn't reflect the law. You're losing time if you're not legally speeding. Beyond that, it doesn't really reflect the way drivers themselves would think about what is lost time versus expected delay versus, you know, something that you plan for and work into your routine. And so the assumption is that anytime you're going anything less than free flow speed, you know, kind of aside from any question about whether free flow speed is desirable, right, you're losing time. And then INRIX also prices that time based on prevailing wages in a city, which doesn't stand up to the slightest bit of scrutiny. City Observatory, which is an urban think tank that we're close friends with at Strong Towns, and we publish them a lot. City Observatory did a great spoof of this a couple years ago called the Cappuccino Congestion Index, where they applied INRIX's exact methodology to the issue of waiting in line at Starbucks. And anytime you have to wait for your coffee, well, that is lost time that you could be earning your prevailing wage. And let's do the math and figure out, you know, and they came up with some absurd number. America loses something like $4 billion a year to waiting in line at Starbucks because Starbucks doesn't have enough baristas. And it's kind of a comical exercise. But it illustrates the sort of silliness of this INRIX approach. You know, there's actually been research done academically on how people actually value travel time based on looking at their willingness to pay to use high occupancy toll lanes that bypass congestion.
Right.
And it turns out that people in this one study out of Louisiana State University a couple years ago, people valued time savings at something like $3 an hour, which is, you know, well below minimum wage, let alone prevailing wages. The notion that little bits of time here and there that you're sitting in congestion translate to lost income in any sort of real sense just doesn't stand up to the least bit of scrutiny.
And it doesn't stand up to our lived realities and a lot of the time. I mean, I think this is the kind of study and the kind of article that you read it and you can't help but insert yourself into what's being proposed, right? You and I, Daniel, we both work from home. We don't commute at all, you know, with the exception of to pick up our respective partners and to go out to the grocery store and things like that. We are salaried employees of a nonprofit. Even if we had an office we were commuting to, we wouldn't make an extra dollar because we arrived an extra minute early. I mean, I guess you could make some sort of broad theoretical argument about if over time we showed up 5 minutes early every day, we would get a real reputation as a go-getter. But it's one of those things that is really challenging. And I think back to the days when I worked for hourly wages and I was clocking it on a computer that calculated my time to like a tenth of a minute. It still doesn't completely jive with the way that I thought about these things. And because my wages were not priced the way that NRAX is averaging out wages. Why do you think people by this line of reasoning, because it's being used to justify some pretty ghastly road projects, in my opinion.
And I think that that is fundamentally why studies like this persist, because they are useful to an industry that wants to justify these big capital spending projects, and they serve a propaganda function. This is something we've talked about before on Strong Towns. We did a whole series in early 2017 about an urban freeway project in Shreveport, Louisiana, that really broke this down nicely. Chuck did an amazing job with that. How these studies fundamentally serve a propaganda function. And in the case of INRIX, the propaganda function is for the agencies and companies that ultimately become their clients. I think the public doesn't so much buy into it in the sense that they've deeply thought about the underlying assumptions and the methodology as that they read an article in their local newspaper about it once a year that says, you know, Boston among the 10 most congested cities in the U.S. I think Boston may have actually been number one this year. And this superficial reporting doesn't really dig into the methodology. So people don't know any better than to take what they're reading at face value.
I think there's something more to it, though, than just that, even. And I will say that that series from Shreveport really laid out nicely how we as human beings are just susceptible to mathification in all kinds of ways, right? We at Strong Towns all the time talk about hashtag do the math, how we have to, you know, make a calculation on how much of our tax base it's going to cost to maintain a road before we build it. We're talking about arithmetic, we're talking about division for the most part and multiplication and subtraction. But stories like this and report cards like this are math as well. And I think that there's something really powerful about seeing a number like, you know, I can't afford to lose $1,348. If that number were 1,400, I would probably be more suspicious of it, by the way. But there's something about the way that calculation lures us into a sense of experts are on this. I don't need to do this math myself because they did it out to this like very specific number. And clearly I must support this, whatever they recommend, because they're smarter than me. How can the average strong citizen compete with that if we're not willing to jump in and become traffic analysts ourselves, if we just want to make good choices as voters and citizens?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, I think you're onto something pretty profound there, that there's this sort of intimidation factor that comes with, well, we did the math and here's a ranking and here are the numbers and here's an elaborate methodology and here's jargon. And people find that persuasive, or they find it hard to argue with without having the same level of sort of technical expertise. I think that, you know, there are arguments out there that put into context what these studies really do tell us and what they can't tell us. And that's something we try to do at Strong Towns. And hopefully we're empowering strong citizens to push back a little bit by understanding the limitations of math used as a propaganda tool or math used in ways that are misleading. I think it's something that city leaders need to understand, and that city planners and traffic engineers need to understand, are the limitations of, well, when is the math we're using, you know, when is it telling us something? Are we doing the math to really become better informed about what's going to make for a prosperous and livable, productive place? Or are we doing it as cover for something we decided we wanted to do anyway? Or are we doing it to appear authoritative?
Right.
I see that a lot with local traffic studies, that, you know, in the city I live in, any development above a certain size is supposed to be accompanied by a traffic study. And it's a cost in the approvals process. The developer has to commission this study, and they will use trip generation rates, and they will use all sorts of fancy formulas to estimate the traffic impacts on existing roads from building this new building, whatever it may be, and from whatever use is going to occupy that building. And frankly, these studies are very pseudoscientific. The trip generation rates come out of this massive manual that are really, really hyper-specific. There's a trip generation rate for a bowling alley. There's a trip generation rate for a fast casual restaurant versus fast food versus sit down of different types. There are trip generation rates for every little niche use you can imagine. And they're often based on one study and a really sort of low correlation or a low level of statistical reproducibility. And yet this do the math attitude ends up getting used as a cudgel. Like, well, the traffic study says, well, how predictive is the traffic study? And more to the point, how relevant is it to what we're really trying to do when we regulate or approve or deny development proposals in a city?
Right. I mean, the thing that I have to make a confession here, I don't love our do the math hashtag. I'm someone on the person on the team who puts together the lion's share of our social media stuff. So I have to use do the math a lot. It's one of those things that helps the Strong Towns message reach more people. But what we really mean is first do the math, then stage an incremental experiment based on what you find in the math and check yourself. You know, that's not a good hashtag, what I just said, if you string all those words together. But, you know, there are endless studies that could be used to justify really, really big mega projects that, you know, if instead, you know, if you believe that study earnestly, you try it in an incremental fashion and give it a shot, come back, see what you get, and then scale up from there, you could avoid a lot of heartache. I keep thinking about, you know, has anyone ever actually gone through and said, okay, has like wage, if we make these changes based on the INRIC study, will wages really go up by $1,348 per year per citizen? No. But that's because this sort of blunt cudgel, I like your term, approach to using studies and mathification to guide our development projects doesn't allow for that sort of retrospection. Cities just have too powerful of an incentive to build, to build the biggest thing that they can, and to use the mathified, you know, stuff to get it in the ground, because growth is good, because growth looks good in a ribbon cutting photo, because growth helps politicians get reelected. And we're not saying that growth is bad always, but we're saying take what you learn and proceed cautiously, proceed by little steps into the dark room rather than one big leap over the dark cliff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you spare yourself kind of the impossible burden of rigor and knowing that your math is right and knowing that your projections for the future are right if you proceed in incremental steps, where the worst case scenario, if you're wrong, is that you pivot a little, you adjust what you're doing a little, you learn from it. If we're not trying to do things, if we're not trying to conduct experiments on our cities, where the worst case scenario is that we're out hundreds of millions of dollars, or that we've ruined a neighborhood, or, you know, something really irreversible, then we free ourselves from the burden of having to have a crystal ball and having to know with precision what's going to happen when we do X. Because cities are complex systems, and it's impossible generally to know cause and effect. We build this, this is going to be the result. This is going to be the effect on where people drive, when they drive, or whether they drive versus taking the bus versus walking versus biking. This is going to be the effect on where new things are built, where they're not built, how residential patterns shift over time. There are so many variables here that to try to present with the sort of certainty, well, congestion in this city is costing us this many dollars down to the dollar. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. Well, and to anchor this a little bit, I want to go back to that Shreveport article you mentioned, Daniel, and I will link it in the description of this podcast if you'd like to check it out yourself. Individual commuter lost wages was not the only thing that they mathified in order to justify the connector project that they were proposing, right? They were saying it's going to, you know, spur this amount of new development adjacent to the highway. It's going to create this amount in infrastructure maintenance jobs, things like that. There's all kinds of things that we use to mathify it. And the real cost, as you mentioned, Dana, was to ruin a neighborhood. Specifically, it was going to plow through what is arguably a pretty great historically Black neighborhood with a strong development pattern on the strength of mathified numbers alone. And they had the insight from previous projects they had done just like this 50 years ago in Shreveport. And by the way, all around the country, urban renewal is something that we have been doing as a nation for decades. And they were choosing to trust the mathified numbers rather than what had happened in the past, rather than history, which has numbers attached to it too. So the stakes in this stuff, it's real. You know, we can laugh about the INRIC scorecard. We can say, what the heck does INRIC stand for? We can sort of bemoan that yet another industry is going to leverage some kind of like hand-wavy numbers to drum up some business for their analysis firm. But at the end of the day, real people are the ones who are on the other side of this. Highway projects kill communities at the end of the day. So just wanted to bring that down to a bummer level for a second, so people know that we're talking about something with some real teeth here.
We really are. The human stakes are really at the core of all of it. I do want to, and I feel, you know, as someone who spent 2 years getting a master's degree in planning, I feel obligated to speak a little bit in defense of doing the math now that we've had the discussion we've been having.
Yeah, please. Love it.
I think there is a need for rigor in understanding what's really going on in our cities versus what we think is going on. And I think it's really important to do the math when it comes to things that are concrete and have a direct real-world implication. So when we talk about doing the math with regard to your city's budget or with regard to the obligations that you've incurred to maintain infrastructure and to provide services, those are real numbers because the budget consists of real numbers. And at the end of the day, you need to pay for these things. And that's very different from these theoretical sort of indirect impacts or indirect costs that aren't showing up on any entity's actual balance sheet. That doesn't mean there isn't a whole bunch of uncertainty when you're doing math looking at property values and tax revenues. There are a ton of variables there too. How is that value per acre going to be affected by what's going on in the broader context of the neighborhood and the city? There are all sorts of ways it can be. So there are a lot of pitfalls there where it's possible to be too simplistic and just say, well, walkable development is worth more, here are some numbers, without context. You always want to have context. You always want to be very careful about your assumptions. But I think there is a need to do the math where the math you're doing is something that has a very direct, real meaning, a real implication for how we go about our business in cities. I might, as sort of a distinction that may be useful, I might say, how complex is the system you're trying to measure in a quantitative way? And how many second and third and fourth order kind of cascading effects are there going to be that are going to interfere with what you're trying to isolate and what you're trying to measure? So the problem with something like traffic congestion is human behavior is involved, and not just the behavior of a few humans, but of millions of humans who are all reacting to each other's choices. And so where a lot of the discussion about something like traffic goes astray is we don't look at the longer term consequences in the bigger picture for development pattern. You know, people respond to congestion. People respond to how long it takes to get where they want to go by making decisions about where they're going to live, where they're going to work, how they're going to get from A to B. And millions of people are all making those decisions independently, but informed by each other. There's a fascinating little idea that I've written about a couple times on the site called Marchetti's constant. Marchetti's not an urban planner or engineer or anything. He was actually a physicist in the 1990s who came up with this idea that throughout human history, people are willing to travel about an hour a day or about 30 minutes each way, kind of round trip to wherever their workplace is or the main travel they need to do daily. And that has functioned throughout history as a bound on city size, that you could look at ancient Greece and you can find cities where the predominant transportation mode was walking, and the city got about as big as it could be such that you could walk within an hour a day and meet your daily needs. And once travel became, you know, horseback, that would change. If it became streetcars, that would change. If it became automobiles on suburban freeways, then the city would evolve accordingly. But you've got this rule of thumb throughout human history. And that really speaks to the sort of self-balancing, equilibrium-seeking nature of a complex system, where it is nowhere near as simple as this is how much time you're losing in congestion, and it has a dollar value, and the only way we're going to fix it is by widening this road or building that road. Well, people are going to adjust their behavior in response to every little change in the system, and it's going to seek a new equilibrium, and that's going to have profound cascading effects that we can't hope to measure or quantify. So that is a very different kind of do the math than how much tax revenue is this property going to bring in this year? And we need to approach it with a commensurate level of humility.
All right. So we're officially getting rid of hashtag do the math, and we're putting in hashtag remember Marchetti's constant, which I'm going to have to learn how to spell. So
I think you might want to get Chuck's presidential input on that one.
Yeah, that's true. We need presidential approval. Let's go to the down zone. This has been a great conversation, but I want to talk to you, Daniel, about what you have been reading, watching, listening to. Doesn't have to have anything to do with Strong Towns. Since the last time we chatted on here, which has been a couple of months, I think, what has been kind of on your media hit list?
So I have been, I think I'm a couple months behind the ball on this one, but my wife and I just recently binged the final season of A Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix, is just delightful. It's super lighthearted. It's absurd. There is so much wordplay, and I am a sucker for wordplay and just hilarious turns of phrase, and odd juxtapositions. So like it's, if you're inclined to dismiss it as for kids because it was a, you know, pretty quick reading kids book series, don't watch it. It's hilarious.
I don't think there's anything wrong with enjoying children's media. I don't know. I feel like me and Chuck talk about this all the time. Chuck has kids, but you and I don't. And I think with the kind of level of heaviness of topics we deal with day to day in our job, it makes total sense that I'm rocking out to Mary Poppins and you're on the Lemony Snicket train. I will mix it up a little bit. I have been watching as many of the Oscar nominated movies as I can. This is my little ritual I try to do every year, and it is very expensive and I never succeed, but I did watch one that I really liked the other day that was nominated for Best Documentary Feature. It was called Hale County This Morning, This Evening, and it was sort of a beautiful and very different way to describe a place. So I wondered if Strong Towns fans might like it. The documentarian, whose name escapes me right now, he's won a lot of prizes as a photographer and a video artist, and you can totally tell by the way he approaches filmmaking. He embedded for a couple of years in Hale County, Alabama, Georgia. Now I'm forgetting the state. Oh no. A southern county. And he followed three young people of color who are for various reasons living and will probably always live in Hale County, which is a impoverished majority Black community that whose economy is centered around a catfish factory. And he approaches it like basically like an impressionistic painter would, you know. It's very like beautiful layered images that are gorgeous, not always extremely narrative, but do tell a story about these people's lives and some of the really gorgeous and also traumatic things that happen to them day to day. And I thought it was absolutely stunning. And I'm not sure if it's the one I'm rooting for. Minding the Gap was also pretty good. And I've got a couple other ones on my list to see. But I hope it gets some recognition at the Oscars or beyond. I thought it was really good. All right. Well, that is what we got for Downzone. Thank you so much for listening to Upzoned. And if you want to support the show, you can do so by giving us a 5-star review on iTunes or whatever listening platform of your choice, telling a friend, helping them, you know, download it on their phone. I just figured out how to download podcasts on my phone at the age of 31. And always, you can support the broader Strongtowns movement by joining it at strongtowns.org/membership. A contribution of any amount is going to go a really long way towards our message of changing our entire culture around growth and development and making it into something that's a little bit more doable. So thank you so much for listening in. Thank you, Daniel, for pinch hitting this week, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.